Since I guess we're ready, this is the case of Isme Mutual Insurance Company versus Eugene Pergamon, MD.
Pergamon, Judge.
Pergamon, okay. That's what I said earlier, and I thought I was wrong. Northwestern Reproduction and Company, Terry Kessel and Doug Kessel. This is 123-0787. Our procedure is, well, first we've just Justice Aurelia Puchinsky, Justice Cynthia Cobbs, and Justice James Fitzgerald Smith. The appellant goes first, has approximately 14 or 15 minutes. We usually don't interrupt unless you get way off the field. Then we ask questions. Then the appellee goes forth with the same, and then the conclusion. With that, you may start.
Thank you. My name is Joel Handler, and I represent the appellant, the appellants in this case. May it please the court. The Circuit Court's entry of summary judgment on April 10, 2023, should be reversed. The plaintiff, ISME, does not controvert, as we've cited in our brief, that where an insurer breaches the terms of its insurance contract with the insured, it cannot rely on the terms of that same contract to avoid its obligations under the contract. And that's from the Shaw-Bovis decision that we cite. The plaintiff appellee brief doesn't even discuss this controlling rule of law. Besides ignoring this rule of law, ISME also admits in its appellee's brief that certain questions of fact existed in this matter, which clearly should have precluded summary judgment here. And that's if you look at pages 126 through 28 of their brief. The salient facts in this case, Your Honors, establish that since the Kessel suit was filed against Dr. Pergamon on May 28, 2010, through December 5th, of 2016, ISME repeatedly indicated it was going to indemnify Dr. Pergamon with respect to that suit. You see, on July 19th of 2010, ISME confirmed that it had coverage for Dr. Pergamon under his medical practice coverage policy, and that the policy limits were $2 million per person and $4 million per occurrence. And that's shown in the record at pages 1447 to 1479 and 1480 through 1514. At that time, Katie Nicholson, ISME's professional liability analyst, made determinations of whether or not there was coverage and that ISME had the duty to indemnify Pergamon. That's shown in the record at 1525. And on that date, Ms. Nicholson indicated that Pergamon would be covered under his policy, and ISME acknowledged that it did insure him for his work as a medical geneticist in his treatment of patients. And that's at RC 1480 to 2531. On November 4th, 2010, Michelle Stenzel, Nicholson's immediate supervisor, made an entry in ISME's notes on this case in which she acknowledged that ISME insured Pergamon for his work as a medical geneticist. That's RC 1480. On November 16th of 2010.
What's the difference between a medical director and what you're calling him?
Because medical director is he's working and doing administrative work, Judge. This what we sued him from the get-go is his individual capacity as a geneticist for the work that he rendered to my clients, and this time it was the Kessels, Taryn and Doug Kessel. So it's all the stuff that we alleged from the first complaint to the fourth complaint that he was being sued as an individual in his individual capacity and not as medical director, because what ISME was claiming is if he's a medical director, we don't insure him for that.
All right.
So on November 16th of 2010, ISMI issued Pergamon a reservation of rights letter in which it indicated that Pergamon's policy provided indemnification for covered claims arising out of the medical care and treatment rendered to patients, and that ISMI would indemnify him for his medical care rendered to the Kessels as a medical geneticist. On October 18th of 2016, Nicholson sent another letter to Dr. Pergamon advising him of the correct settlement demand that were made by the Kessels and that Pergamon's policy indemnified him for covered claims arising out of the medical care and treatment that he rendered to the Kessels, and that ISMI would indemnify him for his medical care and treatment. That's an RC 1910 to 1912. But what do you have? What did we see here in this case? What happened between October 18, 2016, when Nicholson sent that letter to Pergamon saying you're going to be indemnified, to December 5th, 2016, 7 weeks later, when Krista Frick, an attorney for ISMI, sent Pergamon a letter saying that ISMI would no longer indemnify him and therefore directly breach the contract that existed between Pergamon and ISMI? Absolutely nothing that would warrant ISMI to no longer indemnify. Let's go through those events. First, on October 26th, I sent a letter to Eugene Scone, one of the attorneys for Pergamon, to discuss the upcoming deposition of the Kessels expert, Dr. Wayne Grote. And in that letter, I advised Dr. Pergamon that the Kessels were proceeding against him in an individual capacity for the medical care and treatment given to the Kessels as medical geneticists. And that's in RC 1914. On November 1st, Pergamon's attorney, Mr. Scone, sent a letter to Katie Nicholson in which he indicated that ISMI had a faulty approach about the Kessel suit that based on Pergamon's medical care and treatment, and that's shown on RC 1916 to 1921, namely that Pergamon wasn't acting as a director of one of his companies, but acting as the individual geneticist. On November 4th, what happens? The defendants in my case, I was representing the Kessels, took Dr. Grote's deposition. On November 8th, what happens is that Mr. Scone sends a letter to Ms. Nicholson discussing what transpired at that deposition and confirmed that Dr. Grote's opinions were directed to Dr. Pergamon as the Kessels treating medical geneticist. That's RC 1999 to 2001. Pergamon's attorney then followed up with another letter to Nicholson, with an email on November 8th, in which he indicated that the case could be settled within the policy limits, and that was RC 2003. Nicholson responded to Pergamon's attorney by indicating that she was waiting for the full details of the deposition of Kessel's expert, and then ISMI would be taking steps to make a final determination of its coverage position, and that she would provide Mr. Scone with a response. That's RC 2005. Justices, that response never occurred, never happened. The next event was on November 11th of 2016. Pergamon's attorney sends Nicholson an email and indicated that ISMI had been defending the case for 6 years and had the benefit of extensive discovery, multiple expert reviews, and that trial was about 2 months away. And he indicated that he and Pergamon were ready to work with ISMI to resolve the matter. But they were concerned by ISMI's delays. That's RC 2007. And then on November 30th, the defendants in the Kessel case took the deposition of Dr. Gregory Talega. He was a surgeon in Wisconsin who saw Zev Kessel, the child, and that purpose was to determine whether he needed a liver transplant because he had MSUD. That had nothing to do with the insurance issues here. So through December 5th, there was not one stitch of evidence in this case that Nicholson indicated either DeStensel or anyone else at ISMI that ISMI should deny indemnification to Pergamon. Then what you have is on December 5th, ISMI breaches the agreement with Pergamon when Ms. Frick sends a letter indicating that ISMI would not provide indemnification to Pergamon. And it's important to note that DeStensel admitted at her deposition in this case that the evidence showed that Dr. Pergamon was acting as an individual medical geneticist of the Kessels and not as a representative of his companies, and therefore she admitted under the policy, ISMI would be obligated to indemnify Dr. Pergamon. That's at RC 1598. Not only did Ms. Frick send that letter on December 5th of 2016, but ISMI then doubled down on its position on July 11th when Ms. Frick sent an email to Mr. Schoon indicating that ISMI's coverage position had not changed and they were not interested or willing to participate in any settlement discussions. That was RC 2024 to 2025. The evidence here is uncontroverted that there was no event whatsoever during that 7-week period that warranted ISMI's admitted breach of its agreement to provide indemnification to Dr. Pergamon. In fact, ISMI did admit, even in its appellee's brief on pages 4, 5, and 7, that Dr. Pergamon was sued in an individual capacity from the inception of this case back in 2010. Now, what did ISMI do here to challenge that no event occurred between October 18th, 2016, when Nicholson sent a letter to Pergamon acknowledging indemnification, and December 5th, 2016, when Ms. Frick sent a letter to Pergamon's attorney indicating that ISMI now had denied its duty to indemnify. The answer is that they advance a bunch of arguments as shown in their brief, none of which can overcome that the circuit court's summary judgment should be reversed. It first claims that under count 2 of its First Amendment complaint, Pergamon suffered no covered loss. It then claims that it didn't breach the agreement with Pergamon on indemnification because it allegedly followed the procedure prescribed for insurers who do not owe a duty to indemnify. It then claims it had a good faith basis to deny coverage based on the language of the policy, the allegations in the Kessel's complaints, and the facts underlying the claims against Pergamon. It then claims that ISMI's coverage was based on whether Pergamon's covered conduct caused a loss. And then it claims that the settlement agreement between Pergamon and the Kessels was unreasonable as a matter of the law, since it obligated ISMI to indemnify parties not covered by the ISMI policy and exceeded the policy limits, which it clearly did. And then they merely conclude this saying the circuit clerk's denial of the summary judgment on my client's counterclaim was just proper. Let's go through some of these claims. With regard to ISMI's claim that Pergamon suffered no covered loss, it relies on the Guillen decision, which, as we showed in our briefs, actually vitiates rather than buttresses ISMI's position. Because the court says there, where the insurance company breached the duty under contract, an insurer was entitled to have the legally obligated to pay language liberally construed in his or her favor. Clearly, ISMI breached the contract here because of its refusal to indemnify Dr. Pergamon.
It did defend, though, did it not?
It did defend, but remember, Judge, The duty to defend and the duty to indemnify are not coextensive. They're separate, and they're separate obligations, and they're separate obligations under the contract.
Yeah,
So
but
just
I
be
don't have to do anything other than prepare to indemnify if it gets to the point that you show that there actually is an expenditure or damages, and I'm not seeing it here.
well, there is the damage because we entered into this agreement and we arrived at the amount in question. And therefore, when you say, you mean the damage to Dr. Pergament, correct?
Right.
Yeah, well, but it is no different than what happened in the Guillen decision, even though that dealt with a duty to defend. Because if you if they are coextensive, there is this obligation to provide indemnification. So if you had a situation here, if we carried this forward and we went to trial on this case and we would have gotten a judgment against Dr. Pergament then is up the creek because he has no insurance coverage, and that was already determined more than 2 or 3 years before this settlement was even entered. So there, by virtue of the obligations, the duty to indemnify, the duty to defend being not being coextensive, then I think that the reasoning, as we show in the Chael Bovis case, would is clearly applicable here. And clearly would subject ISME to liability, Judge. So, getting back on the, with regard to the claim here, that ISME's contention that it didn't breach the policy by denying a duty to indemnify does totally ignore the evidence that I've summarized for you. There's no question here that the Kessels from the outset of the case were proceeding against Dr. Pergament in an individual capacity and not as the medical director of his company. There is also no merit that to the ISME's contention that it didn't breach the agreement by denying the duty to indemnify because it followed the procedure prescribed for insurers who did not owe a duty to indemnify. What procedure? There was no evidence. There was no evidence of the procedure. When I took the depositions of both Stenzel and Ms. Nicholson, what did they say with regard to that? They said here that there was no set procedure, and it was all basically they had the discretion to do basically whether or not there was a duty to indemnify. That's shown in RC 1644. Thus, ISME did not have a good faith basis here to deny its duty to indemnify, Judge. There's nothing in the pleadings that were filed on behalf of the Kessels that gave ISME an adequate basis to deny its duty to indemnify. In fact, ISME admits that all the complaints that were filed in the Kessel case against Dr. Pergament, alleged he was acting in his individual capacity as the Kessel's treating physician. Thus, the evidence obtained during discovery does not support ISME's baseless contention that here that Pergament did not cause the Kessels any loss in accordance with the provisions of its policy. There was more than ample evidence presented here that showed Pergament's personal liability here. Thus, ISME was not entitled to a summary judgment in this matter for the amount that it was legally that Pergament was legally obligated to pay. The evidence in this case also showed that under count three of ISME's amended complaint, which I believe the circuit court rendered moot, but I still covered it in the brief. The settlement agreement entered between the Kessels and Pergament was reasonable as a matter of law. merely because corporations were included in the release language does not basically negate that agreement. The policy limits also in question, and I don't know where the ISMI was coming from. There was no question. It was a $2 million, $4 million policy, and the settlement, which we disclosed under the confidentiality agreement, clearly fell within that because you had two plaintiffs involved, Doug Kessel and Taryn Kessel. We showed in our brief on pages 19 and 20 that ISMI's reliance on the Transcontinental insurance case, as well as the owner's insurance company case, was misplaced. Because the Kessel suit here was brought against Pergamon under the policy, neither of those decisions indicated that if the settlement was reached with an insured, but the insured's corporation were brought in, were included in the release language, that somehow exculpated the insurance company from having the responsibility to pay the settlement.
You're starting to run out of time.
Okay. Well, all right. I appreciate that, Judge. I'll reserve on deal with it when I come back on my rebuttal. And I would only ask that the court reverse the decision of the circuit court and either enter summary judgment for the defendants in this matter or remand it back for trial. So thank you for your time.
Any questions?
I do have a question. Mr. Handler, you keep saying that the 12-5-2016 letter denied indemnity, but isn't it more accurate to say that they said, we understand we have a duty to defend, we're going to continue to keep doing that, and we believe we might not be responsible to indemnify?
No, I think it says that they're not going to.
The letter said, we do not believe we have a duty to indemnify.
Right.
So that wasn't the same. That's not quite the same as saying we're not going to indemnify. That left it open to a declaratory judgment action for some court to decide whether they had the duty if there was still a question.
Well, I think, Judge, that when someone says, we don't believe that we have a duty to indemnify, and then it's brought to their attention about it, and then they say, we're not changing our position that we don't have a duty to indemnify. I think it's pretty
Well,
clear.
they kept their position was they didn't believe they had a duty to indemnify,
Right.
but their option was always to file a declaratory
Right.
judgment action to find out.
Right. But you
So
have a situation, Judge, where if they go ahead and don't provide the indemnification and
well,
it's led
but
to
they
it.
hadn't denied the indemnification
I
yet.
think
They
they
just said,
I think that they did by
okay.
their subsequent conduct, Judge, because
Well,
what
later
they
after the settlement agreement, but at this point, 12-5-2016, they're just saying, be on notice. We don't think we have a duty to indemnify. Now, and then the law and case law gives them the right to go ahead and file a deck action to find out. So there's sort of a question mark over it, not a definitive, absolute, positively, no, not ever. And that's where I think that you and I are going to have a hard time sort of agreeing on what this whole train of events meant.
Yeah, but again, if they you don't see Judge after the 12-5 letter saying, hey, listen, we're going to go do this to ascertain whether we do have the duty to indemnify.
Well, they had to see what the settlement agreement was first, right?
No, I think what they did here, because the settlement agreement didn't come till late, much later
Much
on,
later, right.
much later on, much later on. And then
Well,
that's when Mr. Schoon was trying to get things going. And basically, it was every response, either getting no response or
let me just, I understand all that, but let me just ask you something. So, having received this 12-5-16 letter that says, we don't really think we have a duty to indemnify, we're going to continue to defend, but we're not sure about this duty to indemnify, didn't that put all the defendants on notice that their settlement agreement better be pretty clear that Dr. Pergamon was personally liable, that it had to be within the limits of the policy, that it had to be for treatment of patients, for medical care, for covered care, none of which is, I don't think, articulated in the settlement agreement. So couldn't the settlement agreement have been written to more narrowly track the actual policy language?
Could it, in theory? Sure, it could have. Okay, but the point of it is, Judge, it doesn't negate the claim here that we're proceeding with.
Well, anybody can make a claim, but here they're on notice in December of 2016. Hey, you're working on this case. Whip it into shape to make sure, if you want to be covered, that it meets the policy.
But
And
when Mr.
I'm
Schoon,
not finding that that was done.
but when Mr. Schoon started, with his dialogue, both with Nicholson as well as the attorneys, to try to get some type of response, either there was no response, or the response was just very superficial here to put him on notice, to
He always
say,
had,
hey,
okay.
I'm
He
sorry, I
always had
didn't
a
mean to
copy.
interrupt you. I didn't
No,
mean to
that's all right.
interrupt you.
I interrupted you, and I apologize for that. But they always had a copy of the exact language the policy required. There was never a mystery. They had the policy in front of them.
I understand
So I don't know what response, other than the letters and the policy, anybody could have asked for.
Well, but it could have been firmer confirmation to say, hey, listen, our intent is to either file suit with regard to the duty to indemnify, which wasn't done. They just did it, later on. After, as you say, after the settlement had been reached. But this is a few years down the pike. So what I'm getting at here is, if you're going to go ahead and you say, we don't believe that we have the obligation to do it, all right? Well, and then Mr. Stone asks for further clarification and doesn't get it. What conclusion does he draw other than that they're not going to provide indemnification? And then when you then look at the deposition testimony of Stenzel as well as Nicholson, they came back and they said, well, we still have, as of today, I think one of them said, as of today, we haven't made a decision yet. We're asking for an advisory opinion from the circuit court about whether we have a duty to indemnify. When clearly the discussion showed that nothing occurred. They never explained, Judge, why they don't have they don't believe they have a reason to indemnify. They never did
Okay.
that. And if they could have done that would have solved a lot of problems.
Well, Mr. Handler, can you point to any specific loss that Dr. Pergamut suffered personally?
The loss that, well, yeah, the that he's, again, in terms of a financial loss, he entered into, entered into this settlement agreement with my clients.
How many dollars did he have to pay the Kessels under the settlement agreement? Any?
Well, he would, if it turns out that this is a situation where he wouldn't have to pay anything,
Well, that's
then
what the settlement agreement says. He's released
yeah,
from anything, right?
then we would have a problem in terms of a potential fraud action on his part. So
Okay, so the answer is, as we're sitting here right now,
right now,
you cannot point to
I
any
can't
amount
point to a
that he
dollar
is
amount and
required.
say this is it.
No, my question was, is he required by this settlement agreement to pay everybody is sorry about what happened to the Kessels. There's nobody that would deny that. But what specifically can you show me Dr. Pergamut owes the Kessels under this settlement agreement? What dollar amount?
Right now, he would not owe anything under the
Okay. So there
terms
is
of that.
no loss to him personally.
Well, personally, but again, the fact that that happened does not kick in the Gehan case because there's a breach of the agreement. They can't use, Judge, they can't use the insurance agreement both as a sword and a shield here, and that's what they're doing. All right, they can't do it. All right. So they have a situation. If you say we're not, we don't believe we have an obligation to indemnify you, You never explain the reason why you don't. Up to date, they still haven't explained the reason why they don't believe they have it. The brief, as you saw, their brief doesn't explain the reason why. The brief doesn't address the Shalbovis case. Then I think under that decision, that decision is controlling here, and they have an obligation to pay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? All right.
I just think that so the real linchpin here is whether there is any evidence of a breach. And is your position that they breached with respect to the duty to indemnify? And if this court were to find no breach, then the legal obligation to pay goes away. Is that right?
Well, if you find that they didn't breach, then my argument is not successful, Judge. But the
right.
point
it
of
goes
it is,
away.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is it shouldn't go away. It shouldn't.
All right.
Okay.
It's the appellee's turn.
Hello, good afternoon, members of the court. James Stamos on behalf of ISMI. I think that throughout the briefing and now in this argument that my colleague, Mr. Handler, and I are talking right past each other, because what's before you is a decision by the circuit court, a summary judgment decision, which was very narrowly based. It's based on the notion that the insurer, Dr. Pergamon, never was obligated to pay. And ISMI's policy, I mean, you'll notice that neither in the brief nor in argument today has counsel adverted to any language of the policy. Is actually asking you to find as a matter of law that ISMI's policy covered the loss here when there was no loss. We'll put that away aside for a second, without ever telling you what's in the policy and how it applies. And we've done that in our brief. And I think that what occurred here was ISMI, in fact, did explain in its reservation of rights letter that counsel referred to a few moments ago, sent a reservation of rights letter at the beginning of the case telling Dr. Pergamon, we will defend you for your work. We will defend you in this case. We will indemnify you for losses that you cause, because it's conduct that is losses due to conduct that is covered by policies, not losses due to what people talk about happened. We will cover you for losses that are based upon your conduct as a physician treating patients. We will not cover you for your conduct as a medical director. We will not cover you for your conduct in any managerial activity. And that's in the letter that they sent. So the idea that there was a mystery as to what the basis for the reservation was, it's just not so. It's in that letter. And when Ms. Frick wrote the letter on December 5th, that was not to Dr. Pergamon's lawyer. That was to Mr. Schoon, who didn't represent Dr. Pergamon. He represented two parties that everyone agreed ISMI didn't cover, which were the corporations. So I, and at that time, Ms. Frick's letter simply said, we don't believe we cover. Well, that's what the lawsuit's for. And the case law we've cited demonstrates that when an insurance company believes that it does not have a duty to indemnify, but the language of the policy, I'm sorry, the language of the complaint, the four corners of the complaint contain allegations that implicate a potential coverage, they have to defend under a reservation of rights, which we did at vast expense, I should say, and through the end of the case. And then the law provides that we may later litigate through a declaratory judgment action whether the conduct that ultimately caused the loss at issue was covered conduct. And here, when counsel says, well, you know, we it was inappropriate that we proceed this way because there was no evidence that suggested that the doctor was doing anything other than conducting himself as a treating doctor. If you look at the third amended complaint, which was the complaint extant at the time of the settlement agreement, the allegations of the complaint itself specifically say in paragraph 3, Dr. Pergamon was at all times the medical director of NRG. If you look at paragraphs 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 10, Dr. Pergamon was the medical director of NRG and NDPC, that both corporations were established for screening certain syndromes, including MSUD, and that Asper Biotech was the agent. And there was another allegation at paragraphs 29 and 30, Dr. Pergamon, NDPC, NRG, those are the two corporations, and Asper breached their duties to the Kessels. So ISMI said, well, wait a minute, we don't cover those corporations. And we don't cover you as medical director. So we're going to defend you under a reservation of rights, but we're going to litigate about whether, if there's a trial in this case, or if there's a finding of fact that takes place during the declaratory judgment case, we're going to find out whether the conduct that caused the loss here was, as a medical director, caused by the corporations or caused by you as a treating physician. That's what's pending, and that is the only thing an insurance company can do. We did precisely as we describe in our brief. We followed precisely the course an insurance company is obligated to follow. And so now let's get back to what we cover. In our complaint, we walk through chapter and verse what our insurance policy provides. And it provides that we pay we pay a loss that is, let me pull up the exact language. I'm sorry, here we are. We pay a loss, we'll pay amounts subject to the limits of liability. Any insured is, quote, legally obligated to pay as damages caused by a covered claim. So unless the insured becomes legally obligated to pay damages, we don't cover anything. There's nothing to cover. And I think what's critical is this is not the first rodeo for the courts in this situation. We cited to the United Services case, a First District 2005 case, as well as the Travelers case, a 2001 Supreme Court case, both of which held that there is no duty to indemnify until the insured is legally obligated to pay something. So we didn't have anything to agree or not agree to do before he became legally obligated. Now, did he ever become legally obligated? That's what the summary judgment decision was about. And that's where the Gillen case comes in. Because in Gillen, what the court was dealing with there was an insurance company that had breached its duty to defend. Counsel suggested that it dealt with breached its duty under the insurance policy. No, it breached its duty to defend, which was the operative event in that case for that insurance company. And as a consequence, in that case, even though you could have read the settlement agreement made by the insured who went ahead and defended itself, there was a family defended themselves and then settled the case, you could have read it as though it was a release. But the court found that, number one, the insurance company could not ask for a strict reading of that language because they had abandoned their insured. And because they had abandoned their insured, the insured was entitled to a liberal reading of that language. And in that case, the court said, well, we're not going to hold them strictly to the language of the settlement agreement, you know, even though technically they weren't going to have to pay at the end. We're going to give them the benefit of the doubt, and the insurance company's out of luck. That's not us. We didn't do that. That's the first point. The second point is, when you go to the Gillen decision itself and what occurred in that case, what the court found was that in Gillen, in fact, the insureds at the settlement agreement that they had did actually obligate them to pay money. According to the court, this is what the payment language of that agreement said. Subject to paragraph 10 below requiring court approval of the settlement. This is in the Gillen case. Defendants will pay plaintiff the sum of $600,000. To be satisfied solely through the assignment to plaintiff reflected in paragraph 10. What the court went on to say was, even though as a technical matter, they weren't ever going to have to pay that money, they were still legally obligated to pay that. And they would have a contract claim if someone tried to collect it from them, if the plaintiff tried to collect that from them. That's not what happened here. I've been doing this almost 45 years. And almost all that time I've done coverage work, and I've never seen a settlement agreement as ironclad as the one that occurred in this case. Because not only was there a release, Dr. Pergament was released. Dr. Pergament was given an indemnity agreement. Dr. Pergament was given a covenant not to sue. And there's a final paragraph, section 1.3, that basically says, for the avoidance of doubt, effectively says, under no circumstances is he ever going to have to pay any money to anyone. And the circuit court read that language and the circumstances here and said, Dr. Pergament was never legally obligated to pay anything. Because the typical situation, similar to what happened in Gillen, but as the Supreme Court discussed in Gillen, the typical situation is where you have an insurance company that abandons their client, they're insured. And the insured says, well, we're going to go ahead and settle the case. Usually what happens is there's a stipulated judgment, and then there's a covenant not to sue. We're going to have a judgment that says we owe you the money, but we're going to have an agreement that you're not going to, ex I'm sorry, a covenant not to execute, that we're not going to come after you for the money. There's still a legal obligation there, but there's an but if you sued for it, you would have the covenant not to execute as a defense. And then there's an assignment. That is not what happened here. The assignment was of something that didn't exist. There simply was no obligation ever. And there's nothing about anything counsel has said here or in his brief that undermines any of that. That ISMI did what it was obligated to do in the circumstance when it had a more than a good faith basis. I mean, counsel didn't touch on some of the facts here. You know, our view of the discovery, as we lay out fully in our brief, is that when you look at what happened here, Dr. Pergamut wanted to develop a laboratory that would be able to test Ashkenazi Jewish people who have certain illnesses that they're prone to, and that could be genetically tested. And he worked with a laboratory in Estonia, invested $12,000 in that laboratory. And as of 2007, 2 years before anything happened in this case, that became the laboratory that everybody that every sample was sent to. It was in our view, an administrative choice on his part, running his business. We're going to use that lab. And that lab happened to blow the reed, as you might say, in the circumstance. But the point being, that wasn't part of his treating this patient. That's just where his office sent the labs, the lab choices to. It would be like if you used Quest Labs at your internist's office, and your lab sends all of your samples go there. That's not the practice of medicine. That's just the business arrangement you have with Quest Laboratories. And that's what we had here. But for the purposes of what we're litigating here today about why we're here, it's the summary judgment that was entered below. And that summary judgment was based upon the complete absence of there ever being a duty to pay any money. And that being the case, there was never a legal obligation to pay. And as a consequence, no matter what other facts exist in the case, they can't recover because our policy doesn't pay unless you become legally obligated to pay something. And counsel, again, has not cited a word of the policy to any contrary effect. And just to touch on another point, to reiterate, the insurance policy, counsel says, well, we sued the doctor in his individual capacity. We didn't sue him as a medical director. Well, first of all, the complaint says references him repeatedly as a medical director. But more importantly, it doesn't matter what the pleading says. It doesn't matter what the experts say about it. What matters is what the finder of fact finds the doctor did. And was it what did the thing he did cause injury? And if it did, is the thing he did covered by the insurance policy? Doesn't matter what Mr. Schoon wrote emails about in his view what the case was about, nor the subjective intent of plaintiff's attorney when he brings the lawsuit. I'm only bringing it as a treating doctor, not as a medical director. Doesn't matter. Question is, was he acting as a medical director at the time, as a factual matter to be found by a finder of fact? And that didn't occur here. We ask that you affirm summary judgment because absolutely nothing we've heard or seen in the brief or argument demonstrates that the circuit court was incorrect in entering summary judgment on count two.
Any questions?
No.
Mr. Handler, you have 4 minutes to
Thank you,
respond.
Judge. Number one, Mr. Stamos indicated no finding of fact here. Well, there wasn't a finding of fact. The circuit court didn't find that he was operating as the medical director at all. Number two, the defendant, ISMI, admitted in its brief, as well as in during the discovery of the case, that Pergamut was sued in an individual capacity. No question about that. Mr. Stamos conveniently doesn't deal with the various allegations of the four complaints, clearly in an individual capacity that he was sued. So what you have here is they breached the agreement. ISMI breaches the agreement. Therefore, under the Bovis decision, they can't go ahead and say, we're going to go ahead and rely on the strict provisions of the insurance policy, and therefore you're out of luck. No, you can't use that. Again, as I say, it's both a sword and a shield here, and that's what you've done. You have a situation where the agreement was entered and Pergament was sued in the individual capacity. He did breach the agreement. And again, as I, in response to Justice Kuczynski's questions, when I said, you know, you have a situation, if you were going to say, well, we don't believe that we have the obligation to indemnify, then you should have been more affirmative in terms of it. When we were, when the, Mr. Schoon was asking questions about it, asking for commitment, they wouldn't give any commitment whatsoever. And therefore, that's why the Guillen decision really works in favor of the defendants here and not the plaintiff. So with that in mind, I would ask your honors to please reverse this decision and as a worst case basis, then remand this matter back for a trial on all the issues that are, because the issues here are factual. And contrary to what Mr. Stamos says as being a, it's a narrow issue, the court, the standard of review on summary judgment, I don't have to lecture you with regard to that, is de novo. And if there's anything in here that would warrant a reversal, which there is, then this matter should be reversed. And I ask that you do so. Thank you for your time.
Any questions? Thank you both. You were both very precise in your arguments. So we'll go back and review what you submitted and also what you argued. This comes down to the contract. So we'll deal with that. Thank you both.